Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. This week, we went to Capitol Hill to interview Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin.
Congressman Gallagher is a Marine Corps veteran, holds a PhD from Georgetown, and worked on foreign affairs and national security issues as a congressional staffer before he was elected to Congress. Most importantly, for realignment listeners, he was Hudson's senior fellow and friend of the pod, Michael Duran student at Princeton. Those who hear in the episode, the relationship got off to an interesting start.
And as we wrap this year, we took a chance to explore all the big themes of our first season with Congressman Gallagher, his takes on foreign policy, technology, and economics. Let's dive in.
Do I get to choose the intro music? Or?
We have a preset there.
Yes.
Okay, Congressman, welcome to the realignment.
It's an honor to be here.
So this entire season, we've had a theory, which is that a lot of the way to explain what's happened in our country post-2016 and the world broadly has been that a lot of the assumptions that we've had about foreign affairs, the role that technology plays in our society, and even like the economy are being upended right now. So a lot of the reason why people are so angry, a lot of the reason why a lot of institutions themselves don't know what to do is all this stuff sort of up for grabs. So we thought it'd be great to sit down with you, a Princeton graduate. Funnily enough, we had Michael Duran on the podcast two times before. He spoke very highly of you, so we're going to have to bring you...
I have a funny Duran story, yeah, if we have time for it.
Yeah, we always have time for Duran
stories. Let's open with that.
Okay, so I was either a sophomore or a freshman at Princeton, and Duran taught the Intro to the Middle That's East right. course, which everyone loved because he was a great... He was the rarest of academics. He was actually a good teacher, and people enjoyed being in the class and didn't spend all his time just doing obscure research. So I like fought to get in his precept, which was the smaller group discussion.
Sure.
And I was so – this is the first professor where I really was like, oh, I love this guy. I want to impress him. The first paper I wrote for Duran's Intro to the Middle East, he gave me a C minus. And you got to think, like, I came to college, you know, thinking I was like God's gift to writing and like studying, and you know, and this was devastating. Like, absolutely,
you fought for this.
And not only did he give me a C minus, and like, this wasn't I just mailed it in. This was I tried hard to write a good paper and got a C minus. This is my first moment in my life where I'm like, oh man, maybe I'm actually stupid. Yeah. I'm not good at stuff. But he not only gave me C minus, he said, this was actually one of the worst papers in the class. I mean, it's a massive course of 300
for,
people.
For all of our listeners, we very much know that he's that blunt for everybody. So I guess it all worked out.
It all worked out. We're friends. Yeah. He wrote me a recommendation a couple years later when I applied to get into Marine Corps Officer Candidate School. And so,
there we go.
And now I watch his Twitter feed with great amusement.
As we all should.
Sorry to go down
there. No, you're fine. This is great. I mean, a quick question then, right? So you're at Princeton with Duran, what, like 2002, 2003, around then?
Yeah.
So what was it like studying the Middle East right after 9/11, right? Because that's sort of one of our big issue areas.
So I remember 9/11 happened when I was a senior in high school. And I mean, we had the sense that it was a huge, massive event, but it wasn't like, you know, I didn't rush out to join the Marine Corps the day after. And we didn't yet know what the impact would be on our foreign policy for a while. And so then I get to college, Princeton. We not only invade Afghanistan, we invade Iraq. And that was the first time in my life where I started to ask these questions of, you know, what are we doing in the Middle East?
Sure.
What is, you know, what is the goal of our policy? What is the goal of our foreign policy more broadly? And it was Duran's essay, which I believe was titled Someone Else's Civil War in Foreign Affairs, that I think was the first thing that really kind of advanced an argument about what we were doing in the Middle East. And but for me, just as someone, that's when I sort of changed my entire focus of study from Latin America to the Middle East. I started studying Arabic. Mm-hmm. And that kind of led me down the path to joining the military. And I would say that, you know, even though the bottom kind of dropped out of the country in 2005 with the Samara Mosque bombing, there wasn't an effect on campus. In other words, there wasn't like a huge anti-war vibe.
It's all Vietnam.
I think most people were perplexed when I decided to join the Marine Corps because it wasn't a thing that you really did at the time. And there weren't a lot of people from Princeton doing that. But they kind of understood that I was a Middle East geek and an Arabic geek and that, oh, of course, this kind of makes some sense.
So this is interesting because you seem to have joined it out of like an academic pursuit and also obviously, of course, as a patriot. But I mean, from this perspective, what Durant argues a lot about, and what this podcast is really is that 2016 kind of demonstrated that the foreign policy elite hasn't really reckoned with a lot of the decisions that they've made over the last 20 years. But you've also got the unique position of, you went to Georgetown, you got the PhD there. I'm also a national security study, security studies program.
Pete Georgetown
graduate.
To reference yes. all that, by the way.
And so, I mean, having kind of a foot in both worlds, yeah. how do you see it? Because at the same time, you're a congressman from Wisconsin, one of the critical states that went to Trump in 2016.
Sure. Well, I do think part of the story, right, if we accept the premise that 2016 was this massive disruption, right, which I accept that premise, or at least there was, it sort of revived this populist sentiment and there was a lot of frustration. I remember always there was this moment when I was campaigning in a kind of blue collar part of my district and a lady answered the door and I gave my whole spiel and she said, "I'm not voting for you. You know, you stink. I hate Republicans." And then as I was walking away, she yelled, "Oh, but I am going to vote for Donald Trump because he's going to shake things up." Yeah. So I certainly think that
there's something there.
Sentiment there's something of shake things up is sure. real. Okay, so what explains it, right? Yeah. There's definitely a foreign policy component. I think it's fair to say that there's enormous frustration with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they represent massive failures of planning, of regional analysis, and intelligence failures at the same time. And they've been enormously costly, and they continue without end, presumably. And you're seeing this sentiment kind of bubble up again, right? There's a weird confluence of interest on the far left and the far right around ending forever wars and, you know, regime change wars. It's not even far left, far right. I mean, there's mainstream politicians. I think Senator Hawley is making this case, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the paradox and why I really don't have an answer for this. We're in the era of the all-volunteer military, right? There hasn't been a draft. I mean, the wars have been extraordinarily costly in terms of their overall costs and then intense personal costs for everyone who's served and the, you know, the thousands of people that we've lost. But I would argue most Americans, if you compare it to the Vietnam era, certainly World War II, haven't borne the brunt of that cost.
No, they haven't.
So why is everyone so pissed off? And the people I think are often least pissed off are the people that have served, right? I see very few people either who have worn the uniform out there making the loud arguments for the foreign policy elite has failed us. And we're engaged in a series of forever wars. And I think Robert Kagan, in his book, The Jungle Grows Back, makes this point that, okay, everyone hates the last 25 years. And there's a sense of we're frustrated with the foreign policy elite. Pick another quarter century you'd rather live in, right? I mean, almost any other quarter century in the last 120 years has had far more failures and far more destructive costs. So I'm at a loss to explain this. In fact, I think the domestic economic variables probably has more explanatory power, right? The financial crisis.
Yeah.
But I'd be curious what you guys have learned in doing this podcast.
So I think, I mean, that I think it's a confluence of all of this, right? Because at the same time, what you're seeing is a frustration of the $6 trillion price tag that was paid into many of these other countries and in the total investiture of a lot of this in that the foreign policy kind of path dependency represents the same type of path dependency that you see in economic policy and all these other things. So it's not, I think, foreign policy and the wars themselves. It's what they represent in terms of a non-reckoning of an ideology. And so, I mean, as a, you know, I mean, I think it's interesting that you are kind of defending that. How does that go over, I mean, in the district, I mean, in some of these, with these people who voted for Trump? There's actually been in some 2017 study actually that showed that places with the higher war casualties all voted for, largely voted for Trump.
Oh, interesting.
And that with less, where there were less war casualties, it went for Hillary Clinton. So there is an important context of this. I don't know if it's the war itself, it's the service members. I think it's the social costs and the path dependency that we've absorbed as a result.
I think to better explain my position, I'm not defending the foreign policy consensus or the blob or whatever we're calling it, correct? Because I think the biggest, the most powerful criticism of that consensus is that foreign policy elites on the left and the right basically made the same argument post-Cold War, right? It was that by integrating China into the global economy, which culminated in their accession to the WTO, we would moderate their political behavior. You know, they would become a responsible stakeholder and we could all, you know, this was sort of in line with a broader academic argument about the end of history.
Right.
Yeah. So that failed miserably, it did. Right?
Yeah.
It was a bipartisan failure.
Yeah.
And I think correspondingly, we've allowed the Middle East and CENTCOM to suck up most of our time, attention, and resources, and we have ignored rising threats in the Indo-PACOM region. So I'm totally on board with that criticism of the foreign policy establishment. And it's one that I did not fully appreciate until I got out of my own bubble as a Middle East nerd and an Arabist and took a broader look, grand strategically, at what was going on. And then I had a second point. What was your
path dependency?
Okay. And then within, I think what, here's what I will defend, however. I think, and there's academic research that I think persuasively backs this up by William Woolforth and others. I think unipolarity is the most stable of all possible systems.
Can you explain what unipolarity is?
So basically, as opposed to sort of a multipolar system in which you have a variety of nation states with similar levels of military capability and other forms of power, unipolarity, which is what the world has sort of been organized under, U.S.-led unipolarity is where you have one dominant superpower. I'm sure I'm getting a thousand things wrong in that.
No,
I've been out of academia for 3 years. Like, I don't read, foreign affairs even anymore. Sure. So. Except for Fareed Zakaria's bad argument in the most recent.
I'm going to dive into that. Yeah. That's going to be perfect because if I'm correct.
Wait, can I just quickly make. So I think we should be prepared in terms of how much we spend on the military and having a forward deployed posture in the Middle East and other regions to defend and preserve unipolarity and the U.S. led sort of system, the free world system. I'm not saying the rules based global order because I think that term has lost all meaning, but I am prepared to. To sort of make an argument for more resources going towards defense and our national security.
I think we're very much with you there. Where Marshall will jump in here, which is that this is kind of the fundamental critique of this Middle East centric policy, but from the right, which is that it is a defense of the international world order, but it's that you missed the ball and haven't really focused on the Chinese threat.
If I don't read foreign affairs either, but I read headlines. Yes. I'm pretty sure you're referring to Fareed Zakaria's argument about the China threat is overhyped. Are you referring to that?
Yeah.
So that's the headline, everyone, if you want to go click on it. But why do you think he's incorrect about that?
Well, listen, I say this. I'm from Northeast Wisconsin. Joseph McCarthy's buried in my district in Appleton, Wisconsin. I get that there's always a risk of going overboard with this stuff. But if anything, I feel like we are not sufficiently woke to the threat from the Chinese Communist Party.
Totally.
It's infiltrated almost all aspects of our defense supply chain, the future of our internet. To me, everything I read and the smart people I talk to suggest that Huawei and ZTE, which are appendages of the Chinese Communist Party, are winning the competition for the future of the internet and 5G. It's almost legalized a form of Chinese influence in this city, in the swamp.
That's right.
We have former Obama cybersecurity officials lobbying on behalf of these companies. We have former senators, members of the House getting paid handsome sums effectively by the Chinese Communist Party to peddle Huawei's narrative and then go around the world. I mean, look at BRI. Look everywhere China is building a port. It's basically captured all of these countries in a debt trap that it's going to be impossible for them to get out of. And look at Australia. I mean, Australia has woken up to the nature of this threat.
Yeah.
It's been, to sort of steal a phrase from a prominent book in Australia, a silent invasion. But it's incredibly difficult because it's so insidious. And we haven't had that moment like we did in 49 with the Soviet nuclear test or the invasion of Korea that would wake us up.
So I think we kind of had, I mean, maybe we disagree on this. We kind of have had that moment. That was Hong Kong, China, and the NBA.
That's right.
We were talking about this with Secretary Pompeo. That was, and Peter Navarro too. That was a moment when I think people realized, wait a second, it's not just this matter of we mind our own business, they mind their own business. Like, there's a direct correlation between the desire to enter into the Chinese markets, and you see this in the same internet sphere, and a lot of the ways that we're going to be treated back home. So, I mean, you don't think that was quite, you think we're still waiting for more?
Well, I think there's something there. So I wrote a letter to the NBA commissioner after that happened, and the other signatories of the letter were Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz on the one hand, and then AOC on the other hand. Like, show me another issue.
That's telling the story. That means something. Right?
I was just at the Reagan National Defense Forum.
Yes.
I mean, everyone was saying the same thing. Even people that are Trump haters were basically saying, you know what? The premise of the national security strategy and the national defense strategy are right, which is to say China is the pacing threat, you know, and we're engaged in a long-term competition with China, and that should be our priority.
And
that's remarkable.
One of the things we talk about here from the very beginning is that one of the everlasting effects of the Trump presidency will be the start of a recognition of a geopolitical competition with China. I think it does come down to how we actually engage in that competition. And that's another thing we talk about here a lot, which is an economic front. So you talked about Huawei, ZTE, basically legalized corruption on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party here in Washington, D.C., Hollywood, in venture capital, and a lot of other areas. So from a government perspective, how can we reconcile? You're a Republican congressman. You're probably raised in the era of the lionization of free markets and all this. And yet President Trump won on a recognition that trade policy, on heterodox trade policy ideas, and using trade as a tool of national security.
Yeah.
How are you thinking about that?
Well, after studying this for a while, I've been forced to accept the conclusion that we will have to decouple key parts of our economy from that of China. I mean, there's just no other way around it. And you have people, you have former Secretary Hank Paulson just gave a speech, I think, in China saying, you know, decoupling is
at
dangerous.
At the Bloomberg Forum.
Parodying the rhetoric. Bloomberg basically saying China's not a threat. Biden having to walk back his accommodationist statements about China. There are parts of our supply chain where we're going to have to decouple from China. And I don't think we can allow China to lay the foundation for the future of 5G internet and beyond. And the risk here is not just that companies like Huawei and ZTE are going to allow the Chinese Communist Party to spy on us, which they are. That's proven fact. Read the Finite States report. Read all the African Union stuff the Wall Street Journal has reported.
Right.
The risk is they drive all their competitors out of business. And we have a weak competitive space. We have Nokia and Ericsson with 16 and 11% of the market share, respectively. Huawei, I think, is at 34% and growing right now. They drive them all out of business. They get a near monopoly. No one else competes for 6G. And then they're able to turn the tables on export controls and forcing countries to adopt their Orwellian vision of surveillance and censorship in return for access to critical technologies. And by the way, for all the companies that want to sell component parts to China, they make the argument that, well, if we don't do it, they're going to build it domestically. They're doing that already.
Yes.
That's made in China 2025. Yeah, exactly. So you can either choose now to lose access to the Huawei market or be driven out 10 years from now.
So here's the question, right? So if we look at the MBA issue, that was an American institution that I think didn't quite realize the geopolitical context and these things sort of changed, right? Like, I don't think anyone pretends. I don't think LeBron James understood the broader implications of what he was suggesting. Another area we see this issue coming about, though, is with technology companies, right? So Mark Zuckerberg gave the speech at Georgetown where he was saying, like, look, we spent years trying to get into the Chinese market. We're no longer going to attempt to do that. So coming from Capitol Hill, what is your advice for people in the market, right? Like people who are trying to, like, it makes sense why you'd want to sell to a billion customers.
Definitely.
How should they be considering this from your perspective?
Well, in the crudest possible terms, and I'm in the House, so I get to be crude. You want us to be sort of energetic and crude, and the senators can sit back, you know, after their afternoon
and they
nap
can be
and sip tea and be, but you do, I think eventually LeBron James and the head of a tech company is going to have to decide what team do they play for, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Free world or the Chinese Communist Party. Perhaps in more nuanced fashion, I think we need to start developing for each industry, and it's going to require a voluntary agreement among players in those industries, particularly the tech industry, something akin to a China code of conduct, right? Mm. You know, this has been most pronounced in kind of the human rights space. Human Rights Watch, I think, developed a 12-point code of conduct. But, it, you know, if we are going to make decisions on doing business with China, here's what we need to recognize explicitly. So the head of Microsoft, he's from my district, great guy, Brad Smith, wrote a good book called Tools and Weapons. They basically have developed this rubric for doing a human rights assessment before they put a data center in every country. Now, I have some disagreements with Brad over, you know, the extant business they have with China, but something like that, we're going to have the tech sector voluntarily step up because we can't do what China does, right? We can't coerce them to adopt certain norms. That being said, we are going to have to find a way to bridge the growing divide between the tech sector and the government, just because we're not, you know, we're relying on them for human capital, right? I mean, we can't pay like a world-class coder enough money to, you know, be a cyber warrior for the Marine Corps.
Healthcare.gov.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's interesting.
I don't know if that makes sense.
It's interesting to know what you said there, though, which is that we can't compel these governments. And I would agree. I mean, you can't compel them to, like, to turn over their data in the way the Chinese Communist Party does or instruct them the way to conduct their business. But, I mean, there's existing legislation, export control, and a lot of these other impositions, which you very much could kind of compel company behavior. Do you not think that that's the way to go?
Yeah, well, I think we've done that pretty effectively in Congress the last 2 years. Yeah. At least send that signal, whether it's, you know, when ZTE was placed on the entities list and then it got taken off for a variety of reasons that we don't need to get into that. Yeah, we should be rigorously enforcing Huawei being on the entity. No. ZTE had a denial order, which is stronger than Huawei is on the entities list right now. We've given a bunch of exceptions. I don't think we should give exceptions to American companies. But I guess I would say defense is only half, if not only a quarter of the battle, right? Okay. In other words, if we build like a digital Fortress America in which we say, you know, no Chinese tech involved, right? Mm-hmm. Just like Fortress America in 1941, that will fail miserably. We need to go on offense in places, particularly like Berlin right now, where there's a fascinating discussion, and say, okay, here is a free world solution for 5G, which we don't have right now.
What's the discussion in Berlin for our listeners?
Oh, so as I understand it, there is a growing coalition in the Bundestag. Am I saying that correctly? Yes. Sorry, I'm a Middle East guy now. I focus on Asia.
In the German Congress.
German Congress, yeah. I did that without an accent. There's a lot of German Americans in Wisconsin. That's why, incidentally, Wisconsin led the opposition into our entry into World War I. And that's what those posters are all about. Oh, wow. 30% of the population was German American. Discussion for another time. That is basically saying we don't want anyone to compete for 5G that is controlled by a foreign government, i.e. Huawei, ZTE. Yeah. And that may be the sweet spot we arrive at, where we develop some sort of universal norm around, okay, the 5G competition can be that a competition, but the systems have to be interoperable and they have to be free of foreign control. And so I think this is actually the most important debate that's going on anywhere right now. It's happening in Britain right now. We haven't even convinced the Brits.
That's right.
Perhaps our closest ally to be with us on 5G.
Well, that's the fascinating part, which is that, you know, in the U.S., I think mainly by geography and at least somewhat of a robust economic system, that we have been able to fight off the worst of this encroachment. But Europe is almost wholesale. I mean, what, one third of their market, their cellular market, is dominated by Chinese technology. And so from that perspective, I mean, how can you compel European companies to behave? Because you can't just instruct them and be like, hey, you need to do this. Part of the Trump, I think, the Trumpian lesson there is that only through like basically compelling them through some sort of action are they actually going to do anything.
Well, I think it's a few things. Yeah. Well, so first of all, you're totally right, and this was illustrated very well this week when Boris Johnson made a statement about Huawei ZTE and then had a Huawei phone.
So I
do think we have not yet made the defensive case persuasively. So continuing to get stuff out there in the public sphere, even if it means declassifying information that we have, to suggest the counterintelligence threat and just the coercive practices that Huawei and ZTE use. I'm going on too long. Do we need to
talk too much? Sorry.
I'm all hyped up, man. I'm
having this is good.
That's why I Diet Coke. So continue to make the defensive case. I've been persuaded that we need something like, and this is, I don't want this to sound like a cheesy, lazy talking point solution, but we're going to need something like a digital development fund where we get together with like-minded countries. A good place to start would be us, Finland, Norway, South Korea.
Producing all these electronics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Some way to level the financial playing field so that when countries in Africa and all around the world are making 5G decisions, they're not just doing it on price, because we can't compete on price right now. Huawei uses predatory pricing, IP theft, and a variety of other things to undercut the global market. Mm-hmm. By the way, that's their narrative right now is that, oh, the U.S. is stifling competition. No. That's crap.
Yeah.
It's Huawei's practices that are taking us towards a future in which they have a monopoly. What else can we do? So I'd be in favor of banning imports of any products that are assessed to be based on intellectual property theft. I think there are ways in which we can not weaponize, but better defend our capital markets, which are one of our core national assets. And right now we have, for example, billions of dollars of federal government money, military service member money that's going to Chinese companies that are doing things like building ships, anti-ship missiles, fighters. So basically we are funding tech that could be used to kill American
through debt
service members
and through financial debt markets.
Exactly.
That's right.
We've just tied that to the MSCI All Country World Index. China pressured MSCI to allow Chinese companies to list on the emerging markets list, which is crazy. You know, think about the political constituency we're creating. The top three, so it was just the markets broadly, right? 150 Chinese companies worth $1.2 trillion. That means a lot of people that are planning for retirement, their well-being is going to be tied to the health of Chinese state champions and Chinese companies that don't have our interests, which means they're going to be resistant to any aggressive action by the U.S. government in defense of our values.
Which is
interests.
Exactly, I mean, that's the Chinese goal. I mean, that's what they want, right?
Totally.
So this is all a good pivot to our last section. So we focused on the economy. And you actually said something earlier that I want to revisit. You were saying that a lot of the discontent could be explained by domestic factors like the financial crisis. And, you know, as someone, were you overseas when the financial crisis went?
I was,
How, can you just expand on that?
Like, I mean, you came back. What did you see?
Yeah. And this ties into socialism and debates over capitalism. Yeah.
I feel like I, you know, personally, I was a little bit insulated because I was in Marine Corps military world. So I don't want, you know, to pretend like I was, you know, on the streets.
A prophet.
Yeah, yeah. I was just getting, you know, bad haircuts every week and doing pull-ups. but I do think, you know, there was, for our generation, right? If I could be so bold as to let myself your generation, right? Sort of the narrative was, you go to a four-year college, you're going to get a good job, right? And you're going to be able to pay off your student debt. I think the economy post-2008 was not a hospitable environment for that. Or you had people that made a lot of economic decisions in 2006, 2007 that found themselves in a very difficult position. And now I think our generation is struggling to get out from under the mountain of debt that incurred, struggling with higher costs of living, struggling with rising healthcare costs that is a function of a government-subsidized oligopoly that is so complex as to be almost mystifying for everyone in our generation. But I think more broadly, I think people in our generation just look at certain things in the economy right now, and they just don't make any sense, right? In other words, I can go on Amazon, I can buy, Jeff Bezos will deliver, you know, toothpaste to me in 2 days. And I've come to expect that level of efficiency and transparency. But then when I interact with, you know, employee-sponsored health insurance, you know, a federal loan for graduate education, or anything else that is tied to a government model from 3 decades ago, it's extraordinarily frustrating. And I think it's created this enormous sense of disillusionment. I don't know. I haven't done enough analysis to suggest whether this explains.
There's a lot that you have to deal with here, so we're not.
Yeah. Like, what do you guys think?
Well, and I think, I mean, this is what I what we really wanted to talk with you about is like from a Wisconsin perspective. A key part of that story is about deindustrialization.
Yeah.
And a key part of the deindustrialization story is tied to China, but broadly, I mean, amongst your own constituents and like just the way that you've interacted post 2016, how is it that the GOP of the future is going to have to grapple with this market question? Because that is really what I think the future debates of the party and of the right and of the left are going to have to be with grappling with so much of the decisions and the impacts of those from the last 30 years.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah. So I cut in real quick just to add something to that. I think what we're getting at, what we've talked about, is that I think it was easy in 2012 to say like, hey, government's going to be like Uber, or look at how like Facebook and Google are super great. And that was a lot of backlash against that. So I think people who sort of are advocates of innovation and alternative structures are sort of left with a lack of, I think, a lack of language. Makers and takers wasn't particularly popular. We have a vocabulary for discussing these things.
Yeah. So listen, to the extent that President Trump has forced the Republican Party to focus more on the working class, sort of the bar room as opposed to the boardroom. And we have a lot of bars in Northeast Wisconsin. 7 of the top 10 drunkest cities in America are in Wisconsin. USA Today every year ranks it. Very dubious distinction. I think that's a good thing, right? Yeah. I mean, people in the lower middle class and want to move up the economic ladder, I think that's a very valuable thing. That being said, I think this analysis that suggests, well, you know, it was Trump's focus on tariffs that won in the election, I think those are overwrought. I mean, to the extent tariffs were part of it, it was part of a broader kind of attitude
it's
that Trump had.
It's a critique against free trade.
Yeah. I don't know. But because on the other hand, I mean, are people not wealthier than at any time in human history?
And yet, I mean, I think the counter to that would be, you know, in places like Wisconsin and in Ohio, they're not wealthier than they have been any time. And they don't have the upward mobility that they had 30 years ago.
That's true.
They could be wealthier, right? Because they have cable TV, they have Netflix, they have but there's a deeper meaning. The critique, you could accept that like living standards are higher, but in many ways that misses a deeper like spiritual or even just sort of basically social desire. So I think we're nearing the end. So our last real question for you is there anything that we've missed? Are there any issues that you as a young member of Congress are thinking about differently or think that need to be on people's radar?
Well, I think just in terms of math, everything kind of becomes a healthcare problem when you look at the budget. And basically, you know, I'm on the Armed Services Committee. I spent a lot of time studying the military. If you compare the Reagan buildup, for example, the age of the 600-ship Navy, all the great things we like to celebrate, and the Obama defense drawdown, which those of us on the right love to criticize, we actually spent more money in real dollars, apples to apples comparison, under Obama. And it wasn't just because our weapon systems got more exquisite and expensive, though that's part of it. The biggest thing was personnel costs. So the military is basically a microcosm of the bigger thing that's happening in society, which is to say we're spending all our money on healthcare and retirement, and it's crowding out the marginal dollars that we would have for
investments in the future.
Infrastructure, meals on wheels, whatever your thing is, right? So that's a huge problem. And healthcare, I don't consider myself an expert. I've done a little bit of work to peel back the onion. It is so extraordinarily complex, yes. But I think we should start with like just solving that problem, and that frees up so much space to do everything else.
Right.
I do think I always get to this point to talk about the broader kind of theoretical stuff you guys introduce, where, yeah, I think ultimately, to the extent we're measuring or looking for an explanation for these bigger trends in pure economic terms, or, you know, GDP per capita, GDP growth, or, you know, standard of living, it doesn't capture that almost spiritual aspect that you alluded to, which is to say, you know, I guess I would say if aliens landed in 1950 and then came back today, the biggest thing they probably highlight is the collapse of the family.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that is I think that's upstream of so many of our problems, but I don't know how you legislate a solution to that, right? Mm. So much of what we're asking people to do is sort of take personal responsibility for things. I think we could start by not, you know, at least not funding the disintegration of the family or paying people not to work. That might be a useful starting point, but I don't know. I really think it's valuable what you guys are doing, just trying to examine these issues. And to the extent you develop a master theory, I'd love to steal it and pawn it off as my own.
Well, by season two, maybe we'll figure it out. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. We really appreciate it.
Thanks
for coming.
It. It's fun.
Absolutely.
All right.
It was awesome.
Thanks, Josh.
Yeah. Fun.
Hope you guys enjoyed our season finale.
Can't believe this is our 19th episode with everybody. We covered a lot this season, and we appreciate you all so much for joining us. Longtime listeners are going to know that the foundation of this podcast is the exploration of post-2016 America and the world through the intersection of foreign policy, technology, and economics.
As you guys know, we had some really great highlights this season. We started off with J.D. Vance, which was a great start for the podcast, not only as a booking, but also because we talked about great power competition with China. And anyone who's listened to this podcast knows that's a topic that comes up every single time.
And somehow we ended up being able to talk about great power competition with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, where we talked even more about China, and we talked about the philosophy behind the Trump administration's approach to the world. As the realignment continued to grow up, we were on Capitol Hill. We talked to Senator Josh Hawley about the failure of so much of the American elite foreign policy, and especially a misdiagnosis of the problem and the theory of the case, really, that the George H.W. Bush administration had about how to approach the world and how so much of our current domestic politic is really linked to that. Now, Marshall, I know you had another particular favorite episode.
Yeah, and my favorite episode was the debate about socialism we had with Bhaskar Sunkara of Jacobin. It got really heated, but it was still civil, and I just had a lot of fun with it. I hope you guys did too.
And then finally, I mean, we would be nothing if we didn't have so many of these Hudson scholars on throughout the weeks. We had John Walters on drug policy. It was an excellent conversation, really likened the current drug situation in America to a mass poisoning. That's a framework I found really, really helpful. Michael Duran also talking about the reckoning of kind of the post-Bush administration era with Iraq and Afghanistan and thinking about the return of states to American foreign policy.
So we had Rebecca Heinrichs, too, who had this really interesting debate that she did at the Oxford Union in England. We were able to come back, sit down with her, and have a really interesting long-form conversation about the actual ideas behind the Trump administration's foreign policy. And then we also had Blaise Mitsal with Michael Duran appearing once again, having a really vigorous debate about Turkey. Funnily enough, one of my friends texted and said it was the first podcast he'd ever listened to that had changed his mind on a topic. So congrats to the both of them for that. Right. And then we finished up with our Hudson Scholars with Robert Spalding, a retired brigadier general who really talked about how his work is dedicated to focusing on a stealth war that China is waging against the United States.
The best metaphor that Spalding gave us was really talking about how that he viewed the damage done to the American middle class and the American industry by China as to what he was trained to do with the B-52 bomber. And I think that exactly is a way of looking at economic policy also as a real tool of statecraft, both by us and by the Chinese. So if you've enjoyed the last few months as we have, we've got some really good news. We're going to be back in the new year with much more realignment analysis for season two.
And all we want for Christmas is for you to rate and review the realignment. We've said it every single episode. We are so close to getting to 200. So if you could give us that for Christmas, Hanukkah, any other holiday you celebrate, that'd be really amazing. And if you have any ideas you want to hear from season two, tweet at us at Hudson Institute or at M.A. Kozloff or at E. Sager.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, sorry.
Damn it. Sorry, I thought that was me. Go ahead.
Merry Christmas, happy Hanukkah, and happy holidays. See y'all soon.